Welcome to the joint meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison and the Madison Skeptics. And John will introduce our speaker. He's for Madison Skeptics. Welcome again to Professor Numbers. You've been here before, and we appreciate your returning to this building and having a chance to hear from you again. This is being recorded for probable broadcast on a low-power radio station in Madison, WIDE-LP. And it'll be available on the website. So, John?
Thank you. I'm John Rummel, and I'm one of the organizers of the Madison Skeptics, and I see a lot of the skeptics here and a lot of people I don't know who I presume are humanists, though I think a lot of humanists are also skeptics, and I think a lot of skeptics are also humanists, so I kind of think that we're all people of like mind and similar outlook on life here. So thank you to Bob for opening up the Prairie Meeting House for us to use today. I've never been here before. It's a beautiful facility. We have had a string of very nice speakers for the Madison Skeptics, and we're continuing that tradition today. Ron Numbers is a professor of the history of science and medicine at the UW-Madison, and he's written a book which is how I know him and know of him, on the history of the creationist movement in America. And I was just talking to him before the program. He and I sort of crossed paths indirectly in a former incarnation of my belief system. I was a student at Grace College in Winona Lake, Indiana, and one of the very significant young Earth creationists, co-author of The Genesis Flood, which is kind of a textbook for the young Earth movement, John Whitcomb, was a professor of mine back in the day, and Ron knows John Whitcomb and has interviewed and studied his work. So Ron's topic today is creationism in all of its incarnations, right up through intelligent design, the most recent movement. And I've told him to, you know, allow for an hour plus or minus, and he's also very happy to do Q&A either during or after, or, you know, however you prefer it.
Anytime.
And so it's with great pleasure we introduce Ron Numbers.
Thanks. Well, I'm happy to be back here. I believe it was a few years ago when I spoke to the humanists. I'm still trying to sort out how to distinguish between humanists and skeptics. And would most of you be Unitarians too?
Not necessarily.
Well, yeah. Okay. And then, what's the difference between a Unitarian and a Universalist? I know historically what's the difference, but I've never known too much about the current. Yes?
It said that the Unitarians felt that the Universalists felt that God was too just to send them to hell, and the Unitarians felt that they were too good for God to send them.
There you go. That sounds about right to me. Yeah, right. Yeah. I always thought that Unitarians were the upper class skeptics and the Universalists were the lower class, and they finally came together in democratic ways.
That is accurate
historically. Yeah. I'm not a member of any official skeptics group, but I've been a subscriber to the Skeptical Inquirer since before it was the Skeptical Inquirer, since it was the Zetetic, and I've always enjoyed reading that type of literature. In my academic work, I try to take a more balanced position and don't advocate one position over another, but simply try to understand why people believe weird things. Having been, like John, one of those people who grew up believing very strange things, it almost comes as second nature to me. So, this year, as I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, know, is the Darwin year. The 200th anniversary of his birth, the 150th anniversary of the origin of species. And there have been, since January, celebrations around the world, and they'll continue through the end of the year. I started out in January in Cuba for their Darwin celebration and made it to the Vatican's in Rome, where, as you might guess, the Pope stood us up. He was supposed to meet with us, invite us over to the Vatican on Saturday morning, and on Friday we got an announcement that he was canceling to do spiritual exercises. And I'm still trying to figure out or even imagine what a spiritual exercise would be. It's not part of my, well, maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's not part of my tradition. Yeah, it could be. And there are many more scheduled to come. And I'm always the odd man out at these events because everybody just about is celebrating Darwin. And I come along and remind them that for most of the world, Darwin is not a hero. In fact, you may be aware that just in the last couple of years, there have been two surveys in Great Britain that have shown that under half of Britons believe in Darwinism. And one of the things I won't lecture on this afternoon, but I'd be happy to talk about, is the growth of anti-evolutionism around the world, beyond the United States, beyond fundamentalist community, really doing well in Islamic circles and in ultra-Orthodox Jewish circles and in other contexts right now. So it's kind of it's counterintuitive. 50 years ago, I don't think many people would have predicted that this would be going on. Now, at the risk of telling you things you already know, I will spend the rest of my time trying to identify as precisely as I can the different varieties of anti-evolutionism in America. And I know that many people think that because anti-evolutionism or creationism, as it came to be called, is derived from the Bible, that there's been no change. Well, that's wrong. I think one could make a good case that creationists as a group have changed as much during the past 100 years as evolutionists. Actually, I have used that as a title, The Evolution of Creationism in America. Indeed they have. Once created, then they... The question is this micro or macro evolution that they've been experiencing? So we can talk about that.
Are they more complex?
Back in the 19th century, in the years following the publication of The Origin of Species, there were a number of outspoken anti-evolutionists, but there was no organized anti-evolution movement in America and no group that called itself creationists. In fact, applying the term creationists to anti-evolutionists really didn't come about until about the third or fourth decade of the 20th century. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One is that the term creationism had already been used in a theological dispute about the origin of the soul. So you had traducianists and creationists. And this was a long-standing debate about whether God gave Adam and Eve souls, and then through a fairly natural process, they got passed on to humans, or every time there was a conception, or maybe shortly after that, God created a new soul. And there was this long-standing debate, but that was what a creationist typically meant when Darwin came along. Just a very few times Darwin actually used the term creationist as a synonym for anti-evolutionist. The other reason why there were why people didn't go by the name creationist is that they were so divided about the correct interpretation of Genesis. And let me just go back to the 1920s to tell you about the three primary interpretations of Genesis that were vying for the allegiance of fundamentalist Christians. It may come as a surprise to some of you to know that fundamentalists in the 1920s typically read the Bible in a way that allowed them to accept the antiquity of life on earth. So-called young earth creationism was a minority view among the anti-evolutionists in the 20s and remained so until about the 1960s. Now, you're all familiar, of course, with William Jennings Bryan. And if you've watched the movie Inherit the Wind or read about the Scopes trial in a textbook, then you're wrong. Virtually everything that passes for accurate information about Bryan is wrong. Although the movie's a great movie and the moral is wonderful, it has little historical value. Bryan, you may recall, the Bryan character in the movie is being examined by the agnostic attorney Clarence Darrow, and Darrow gets him to say, yes, creation took place on October 23, 2004 BC at 9 a.m. And Darrow, the skeptic, says, would that be Eastern Standard Time or Mountain Time? The problem with that whole scheme is that Bryan, to my knowledge, was never a young earth creationist, and the transcript of the trial has been available to scholars since the end of 1925. All they had to do is get a copy out of the library and see, what did Bryan say? And Bryan was pretty strong in defending a theory known as the day-age theory of Genesis 1. That the days of Genesis represented vast geological ages. And so, in exasperation at Darrow's pushing him on this, Bryan at one point says, we anti-evolutionists don't care whether creation week was 6 days or 6 years or 600 years or 600 million years long. It makes absolutely no difference to us. This was a very common opinion, as counterintuitive as it might seem today, among the anti-evolutionists, the leading anti-evolutionists in the 1920s. It was the position strongly advocated by the founder of the World's Christian Fundamentalists Association, a Baptist minister in the Twin Cities, who named William Bell Riley, who was one of the leading fundamentalist organizers during this period. It was he who arranged to bring Bryan down to Dayton to represent, to help with the prosecution during the trial. I can't resist telling you an anecdote now. So, just before the trial, Bryan wrote to a number of anti-evolutionists who had some scientific credentials, trying to see if they could come down and testify for the prosecution. And one of the people he contacted was Dr. Howard Kelly, who was arguably America's leading obstetrician and gynecologist. He was the professor of these subjects at the Johns Hopkins University Medical School, and was a well-known evangelical Christian. And so Bryan writes to Kelly and said, I'd really like to have you come down and help out. And Dr. Kelly wrote back and said, well, Mr. Bryan, I greatly admire what you're trying to do to restore the moral fiber of America, you know, opposing alcohol and evolution. But he said, I wouldn't be very good because I'm willing to accept evolution up to humans. It's just human evolutions I have the problem with. And Bryan wrote back and said, well, Dr. Kelly, I wouldn't want you to spread this too much, but I agree with you. I don't think there's any theological problem with pre-human evolution. It was the moral issues associated with evolution that really bothered him. And that was true of a great number of anti-evolutionists. Now, I don't want to leave you with the misleading impression that Bryant accepted pre-human evolution. He just said if the scientist ever came up with the evidence, it wouldn't be a theological issue for him. As he traveled around the country lecturing on this topic, he liked to give the example of how biologists explained the origin of the eye. And the eye had caused people, it caused Darwin sleepless nights, and his leading disciple in America, Asa Gray, was very concerned about the eye. In fact, he said, I don't think evolution can explain complex organs such as the eye. So he put that outside the scope of evolution. But Brian would tell people, you know, these biologists, evolutionary biologists, believe that in the past there was, some little furry animal that developed a mole that was sensitive to the light. And it felt good when the light would shine on the mole, and so the animal would turn to get the maximum amount of light. And over the years, this characteristic was passed on to the descendants. And over a long period of time, it became optically sensitive. And finally, after millions of years, evolved into the vertebrate eye. And Brian's punchline was always, can you believe it happened not once, but twice? Yeah, he always got a chuckle for that. It is amazing when you think about it. I mean, I don't want you to start thinking about intelligent design here, but twice. Okay, so you had this one large group of fundamentalist anti-evolutionists in the 1920s, including some of the most prominent voices, saying, look, a literal reading of Genesis 1 shows that the days of Genesis are long periods of time. The Bible itself said a day in the eyes of the Lord or as 1,000 years. It wasn't unbiblical. One of the trickiest terms in talking about fundamentalists is probably the term literal or literalist, because these people are literalists in their hearts but not in their practice. They devote bookshelves to interpreting the symbols of the biblical prophecies in Revelation or in Daniel. Most of them, are you familiar with Daniel and Revelation? Talks about some wonderful things like 10 horned beasts and the whore of Babylon. And most of them don't think it's a real whore. I mean, they know who that is. I can't say anymore. But so that's what they were all about, was interpreting biblical prophecy. They were concerned about end times more than anything else. And that played a role in the anti-evolution movement, to try to get people to take Genesis as seriously as they took the prophecies in Revelation. So literalism does not necessarily mean a literal reading, that Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt. That could be symbolic too. By this time, even a number of fundamentalists were accepting the notion that Noah's flood may have been a local event. And they considered that a good literal reading of Genesis. So just have to be very, very careful when we talk about that. Now, a group I think was even larger within the fundamentalist anti-evolutionist group in the first half of the century subscribed to another interpretation that was called variously the gap theory or the ruin and restoration theory, which was another way of accepting the compelling evidence for the history of life on Earth that geologists and paleontologists had discovered in roughly the years between 1810 and 1840. So by 1840, virtually no evangelical Christians who were writing on the topic were doubting the antiquity of life on Earth and had rejected the notion that Noah's flood had deposited the fossils. That had been a fairly popular idea among some, but there was no evidence to support it. After all, God had sent the flood to destroy wicked humanity. Some innocent animals got caught up in this too, but it was primarily to punish humans. And as geologists and paleontologists started uncovering the fossil record, the one thing they didn't find was human fossils. Very rarely did they ever turn up a human fossil. So what's that all about? If the flood was associated with Noah's deluge, then it should be full of human fossils. And so the common tendency of the Bible believers was to retain belief in the flood, but put it beyond the geological column. In other words, rather than the flood being responsible for all the geological column, there was no geological evidence of Noah's flood. It was past where the geological column ended. So this gave them a fair amount of freedom to interpret it. And the most compelling explanation for why this was so popular among fundamentalists, and as the Pentecostal movement was growing rapidly in this period, fundamentalists loved this. Pentecostals loved this along with fundamentalists. Was that their favorite Bible said so. Some of you may have heard of the Scofield Reference Bible. It was brought out by Oxford in 1909, and it was the King James Version, but with helpful editorial notes. If you've ever spent any time reading the Bible, you know that some passages are really difficult to understand. And Mr. Scofield thought he would help the bewildered by explaining just what these passages meant. So at the bottom of the first page of Genesis, he explains that Moses, clearly the author, was trying to give this ruin and restoration or gap interpretation. So you move up the margin in the middle, and you do find 4004 BC, but that's for the Edenic restoration, not for the creation at the beginning. You have this big gap in the beginning between in the beginning, and Moses never says when that was. And then he passes in silence this long period of time where the whole geological column is laid down and gets finally to the Edenic restoration associated with Adam and Eve. And so these Bible-believing Christians, these literalists, could slip probably should go this way, could slip the entire geological column in between the beginning and the Garden of Eden here without any problem. And the scientific evidence certainly seemed to warrant that. And now after 1909, in the Scofield Reference Bible, you could get it directly from your Bibles. So that became extremely prominent among the rank and file fundamentalists, and as I said, Pentecostals as well, during the first half or so of the 19th century. Yes?
While you're on the Scofield Bible, I've not seen one. Does that carry all the way through the entire Bible, or is it just that period?
It doesn't even carry through to the Scofield Bible today. I don't know. I can't recall. It's been updated since Mr. Scofield died. And I'm pretty sure it doesn't endorse the gap theory anymore for Genesis 1. And I don't know of any other place where that's referred to except in the notes accompanying Genesis 1. I don't want to anticipate what I'm about to say. Now, there was only a tiny group among anti-evolutionist fundamentalists in the 1920s and 30s who used the really old-fashioned interpretation of saying it's no more than 6,000 years old, creation was in 6 24-hour literal days, and by that time you had to find some explanation for the fossil record, for the geological column, and they said Noah's flood did it. All those people in the 1920s, until about 1929, were found in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And there was a reason for this. They had been founded in the mid-19th century by a young prophetess who would go into trances and have visions directly from God. And on one occasion, when she was wondering about the correct interpretation of Genesis, God took her back, as Adventists firmly believe, actually to witness the creation. And she saw that it had occurred in 6 24-hour periods. Well, since Adventists believed and still believe that her writings are as inspired as the writings of the Bible, they got locked into this. And it was one of her disciples named George McCready Price, who in the early 20th century started writing book after book after book, developing this idea from Ellen White and propagating it first under the label flood geology, occasionally the new catastrophism. And it was that idea that in about 1970 got renamed creation science or scientific creationism. So you had in the 1920s, and one could say, you know, up until after World War II, two interpretations of Genesis struggling for popularity among fundamentalist Christians, but both of which accepted the evidence of geology and paleontology. It was especially human evolution they didn't accept, but they were by and large anti-evolutionist generally, but not opposed to the antiquity of life. So the big story for creationists comes with how this minority opinion associated with a despised cult. Now, fundamentalists don't like any extra-biblical source of revelation, and the Adventists, like the Mormons and the Christian Scientists, had an extra-biblical source of revelation, and that's not very good. So they kept the theology very much at arm's length, and it wasn't until, as John explained, that John Whitcomb and Henry Morris in 1961 took Price's views and sort of repackaged them in a more scientific way and issued them as the Genesis Flood, that really touched off the movement for fundamentalists and other conservative Christians to gravitate toward young earth creationism. Whitcomb and Morris never dreamed that they would convince the scientific community. Their goal from the beginning was, number one, to defend Price, as they said in their correspondence. But more significantly, they wanted to wean Christians away from what they regarded as compromising interpretations of Genesis that had been introduced simply to accommodate the findings of science. They said, what we should be doing is start with the plain reading of Genesis and then try to create a model of Earth history that will fit with that. Instead of, you know, geologists tell us we have hundreds of millions of years, well, I guess we have to interpret Genesis to to accommodate hundreds of millions of years. And they were immensely successful. In order to get into the public schools, they renamed this biblical creationism, or flood geology, as it was sometimes called, creation science or scientific creationism, to make it as secular as they possibly could. Scientific creationism was exactly the same as biblical creationism in terms of the sequence of events and the dating. It just happened to be stripped of all references to the Bible. So no mention of God, no mention of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, no mention of Noah. But you have this worldwide catastrophe, you have a recent appearance of life, etc. And that they tried then to push into the schools. By the late 70s and early 80s, these people, the advocates of scientific creationism or flood geology, whatever you want to call it, had become so successful that they had co-opted the label creationist for their views. So friend and foe alike believed, if you said you were a creationist, that you were a young earth or scientific creationist. And the other people who had once been the orthodox fundamentalists would have to say, well, I am a creationist. I feel I'm a creationist, but I don't believe in this young earth stuff. And I don't think the fossil record could have been deposited in 1 year. One more aside, just to enlighten you about a point that is almost universally misunderstood about young earth creationists. I run into it all the time among scientific colleagues and others who tell me, look, I have to be married to an evolutionary biologist, so I get the latest news quickly at breakfast. We've now seen a new species evolve. You know, we have evidence. It's not just hypothetical anymore. We can do all sorts of things now. The creationists should just fold up their tent and leave. You know, they've been proven wrong. Well, since the flood geologists, these young earthers, have come into the ascendancy in the anti-evolution community, they have accepted a tremendous amount of evolution. And here's the reason why. It's the fault of the Bible, actually. Unfortunately for them, the Bible does indicate two restrictions. One is Adam named all these animals in like an afternoon. You know, they go by him and he gives them names and stuff. And if you're a literalist, then that's before dark, probably, he did that. Even if you have them trotting along very fast. Zoologists have just invented so many species in the last couple hundred years. It's almost unconscionable. I was talking to one entomologist last night who said there are probably about a dozen species of mosquitoes in Wisconsin alone. It's like it's one to me, but I'm just a historian. Anyway, so you had that limitation. How many animals could Noah have in real life named in an afternoon? But worse was you have the dimensions of the ark. Well, that's restricted. So even if you make them all hibernate during the little junket, so you don't have to have any room for food, and you get them in a really small cages where they don't have to move around or anything, you still have an upper limit for the number of cages or whatever you're going to use to house these little creatures, big creatures too, like elephants, dinosaurs maybe. And so you have this upper limit. And that was really hard for the flood geologist who hinged everything on Noah's flood. So beginning by the 40s, they started saying, look, there's no biblical reason why we should defend species. The Bible never mentions species. This is just a stupid thing. When there were a few species, we could get them all in the ark. What was created in the beginning, what Adam named, and what was preserved on Noah's ark were the kinds. Kinds. And one of the PhDs in biology, who was a leader of this growing creationist movement, said, let's call them Baramins, B-A-R-A-M-I-N-S. Well, that name didn't catch on too much until recently. But the idea took hold because it solved a significant problem for them. So you have, if you're a young earth creationist, you have in roughly 4,300 years since Noah's flood to take the originally created kinds who made it on the ark and got off. They have to evolve in, say, the canine kind. 4,300 years, they've got to produce the foxes and wolves and coyotes and all the domestic dogs. There is no sane evolutionist in the world who has evolution going on that fast. They need all the natural selection they can get and any other kind of selection. The only thing they're reluctant to do is have a special recreation after the flood. Every now and then there'll be a creationist who come up and say, it can't be done that fast, and I think God repopulated the earth after the flood. But the leaders typically say, that's extra biblical. Can't, you know. Why would God have gone to all the trouble to have the ark built and preserve the animals if he was just going to recreate life on earth afterwards? So that's never really, one very prominent creationist has urged that, but it's never really taken off. And in recent years, we've seen the establishment of a baraminology study group, the goal of which is to determine scientifically what the originally created kinds were and the types that were preserved on the ark. So it's been about 50 years since I've run across young earth creationists defending the special creation of species. It's almost always their opponents who say, oh, they're still arguing for the special creation of species. No, they're not. They couldn't and get away with it. Maybe some ignorant creationist somewhere is doing that. But it's kinds that they're all about. And the evolution that takes place within a kind or a baramin is, by definition, microevolution. If it goes beyond a kind, it's macroevolution, and that's satanic. Okay, you got to keep evolution within the kind, and that's just fine. So they can have more evolution in a shorter period of time than any mainstream biologist can. Just can't go beyond the kinds. Okay, back to 15 minutes to get to the mainstream here. Let's turn our attention to legal issues now in the last 15 minutes that we have. In the early 80s, the advocates of young earth creationism, or creation science, decided to make another push to get into the public schools. That's what creationists really want to do in America. In Great Britain, sort of the holy grail is to get on the BBC. That's what their schools don't. There's no separation of church and state in England, so that's not a big issue. They can get into the schools relatively easy, but getting on the BBC has been what they've been after for a long time. But in the United States, it's getting into the schools. And in the late 1960s, the Supreme Court finally ruled that the old laws that remained on the books from the 1920s, anti-evolution laws, were unconstitutional. So about 1980, creationists got to thinking, let's go for balanced treatment. I mean, that sounds really democratic. You know, balanced treatment, open up minds. and get state legislatures to pass laws that would make it mandatory to teach creation science anytime something called evolution science was taught in the classroom. And two states, Arkansas and Louisiana, passed laws that mandated this. They immediately came to trial. The first one was in Little Rock, Arkansas, where a rambunctious young philosopher of science tutored the judge on the demarcation criteria between science and non-science, which the judge bought lock, stock, and barrel. The philosopher was Michael Ruse, who was quite a good friend of mine, and he told the judge, he says, you know, there are five criteria we know distinguish science from non-science. It has to be falsifiable. It has to be testable. And I say, Michael, stop right there. I don't know the difference between falsifiable and testable. And you're having both of them as criteria. And then it has to be tentative. Well, that's a troublesome one, because so many biologists keep saying that evolution is a fact. That doesn't sound tentative to me. If it's a fact, it's a fact. It's truth to me. It had to be natural. I agree on that's my criterion, by the way. Not that I originated, but that's the one I think is today the number one criterion. I can't even remember what his fifth criterion was. And he got beat up by historians and philosophers of science for introducing an idea that nobody believed in anymore. But he said, but it worked. And in fact, the Supreme Court in 87 adopted this notion, because you have to show in America that these anti-evolution ideas are religious. I was recruited, actually, by both sides in the Louisiana trial. I like to think that it represents how balanced and objective I am. Friends of mine say it just shows how wishy-washy I am. But I did go with the ACLU, but was virtually worthless, because my strong opposition to teaching creation science, the one I really believe in, is it's garbage science. You know, it's bad biology, it's bad geology, bad astronomy and physics and everything. But as the lawyers were quick to explain to me, it's not unconstitutional to teach bad science. You have to show it's religion. Even bad philosophy wouldn't be enough. So we get these very narrow arguments because of our particular legal context here that makes us all try to argue it is not science. It can't be just bad science. It has to be not only not science, but religion. Then you can rule it out. Well, as these cases were moving up from the state level to the Supreme Court, it took years. It was 86 before the Supreme Court heard this case, in 87 before they ruled. Some enterprising creationists thought, well, if the Supreme Court should rule in our favor, there would be a huge demand for creation science textbooks. So they got to work on one called Biology and Creation, and started contacting publishers, promising that they could make probably $5 million in the first 5 years if they would publish this book, if, of course, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. Well, the Supreme Court didn't rule in their favor, as we all know. But these people weren't too discouraged. They immediately just went through and changed all the references to creation to something called intelligent design, and issued the book in 89 as Pandas and People. And that became, in effect, the first intelligent design work. The information about the origins of Pandas and People didn't come out until the Dover trial a few years ago, and confirmed for many people the notion that intelligent design is nothing but another name for scientific creationism. And let me just, in the last few minutes I have, try to disabuse you of that easy solution. That certainly happened. Unfortunately, well, I don't know if it's ever unfortunate, but that's the only evidence I know that connects creation science with intelligent design. So remember, the goal of the scientific creationist has been, one, to focus on the correct interpretation of the Bible, a young earth version that puts almost all its weight on the Genesis flood. That's absolutely crucial. If they're not talking about the Genesis flood, they're not talking scientific creationism, almost. It's almost that simple. Because that's their big challenge. They don't talk about creation that much. It's what happened at the flood. So their argument has been biblically based and has not even included in the community the day, age, and gap people who were the leaders of the anti-evolution movement back in the 1920s. So along came the intelligent design theorists who said, look, this is ridiculous. Why are anti-evolutionists prematurely insisting on a particular interpretation of Genesis? We don't care what version of Genesis they accept. We don't even care if they're Christians. We want to create a big tent of anti-evolutionists that will set aside the Bible. That's going to be a personal thing. What you believe, we don't want any talk about the Bible, and we want more respect. We don't want to just be these fundamentalist Bible believers. So they set out consciously to create a community that would distinguish them from the young earthers. Now, they're one or two in among the leaders of the intelligent design movement. They're one or two creation scientists who are active. But by and large, these are two separate communities demographically. And their message is fundamentally different, except for they both hate evolution. And I tend to divide intelligent design into two versions. One I call the weak version, and the other I call the strong version. And when I talk to people about intelligent design, often, if they like it, they like the weak version. You know, they don't know it's a weak version. But by that I mean that the intelligent design people have argued that the complexity of the world, especially of the organic world, and especially subcellular organic world, is so incredible that it necessitates a belief in a designer, God, they sometimes say, but not usually in their publication. And since all anti-evolutionists and many theistic evolutionists believe in a designer God, there's a huge reservoir of support for that sort of weak notion. Yes, there's a lot of complexity. There are two eyes. So talking about that shouldn't be inappropriate. It seems to many people to be just a version of natural theology, which was very common in the 19th century. With the one problem that the intelligent design theorists strongly claim that they're not doing natural theology, they're doing science. And that gets to the strong case for the strong version, not case for, version of intelligent design. Back in the early 19th century, investigators of nature, who were soon to be called scientists, increasingly reached a consensus that said, when you study nature, no matter what your religious convictions, You can't use miracles as an explanation. That's cheating. Okay. Now, before that, so say the 17th century, early 18th century, one of the most common students of nature were called natural philosophers. Newton was probably the most famous one of all. And if you were doing natural philosophy, although there would have been a preference for natural explanations, it was not inappropriate to introduce God when you thought God might be helpful. And so in the Principia, Newton a few times introduces God. Okay. By the time this new entity called science comes into existence in the early 19th century, its primary characteristic was no God talk, no Satan talk. Didn't mean that you couldn't be a good Christian. And the Christians bought into this, left and right. There were a few criticisms of this, mostly from clerics, who didn't like the way that students of nature had taken a word that had been a synonym for knowledge and were now restricting it to natural knowledge, which kind of threw them out of the game. So there were some, you know, whimperings about that. Even your creation scientists agreed with this, that when you're doing science, you can't appeal to God. When they appealed to God, they said, we're not doing science anymore. That's religion. Intelligent design leaders said, this is a terrible thing. Not being able to refer to God is the moral equivalent of denying the existence of God. This is atheism by any other name. And the worst part about it is that Christians have bought into it, even evangelical Christians. And this approach didn't get its name. Methodological naturalism is the name that's now used to describe it, until the mid-1980s, and it appeared in the Christian Scholars Review in an article by a theologian and philosopher at Wheaton College, who said, this is what evangelical scientists should do. This is the philosophy they should adopt, which was the conventional philosophy. You bracket your religious views, and just when you're doing science, you just use natural explanations. And so there's no problem for a Christian there. So this just bugged the hell out of the intelligent design people to have Christians saying, this is the way we should be doing science, by deliberately and arbitrarily excluding God from this. And they said, and I guess they're right historically, you know, if the students of nature could, in the early 19th century, exclude the supernatural, by God, we can bring the supernatural back in. And we want to call it science, because it's warranted by the complexity of nature, what one of them liked to call irreducible complexity. So that's where we stand now. One final comment. The drive to push intelligent design into the classroom failed in Dover, Pennsylvania. And just a wonderful decision by a very religious judge, Jones. But that doesn't mean that either intelligent design or scientific creationism is going away. Already during the trial, the Discovery Institute, which is the headquarters of the intelligent design movement, pulled its people out of the trial. They were going to lose them. They knew they were going to lose. One of them stayed in on his own. He was in Pennsylvania. But then changed the tactics to see if they couldn't adulterate their views just a little more to get over the constitutional hurdle, and began advocating teaching the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. And we all have a school district in Wisconsin that is trying to implement that. It's not on the face of it unconstitutional. It doesn't say anything about religion. although some courts have ruled in the past that the fruits of the poison tree are enough to make it unconstitutional. That is, if the motivation behind something that looks secular is really religious, then you can stop it on constitutional grounds too. I hope we get another Supreme Court justice quickly, because I wouldn't want to bet that the present court, if a case went up there, would rule against it on constitutional grounds. And in fact, I've been told by knowledgeable lawyers that one of the reasons we don't see the ACLU taking one of these cases right now is they want to wait. They're worried too. And the last thing you would want is to get the Supreme Court to rule that this was constitutional, because the primary goal is not to teach the strengths of evolution. It's to open the door for teaching the weaknesses of evolution and to protect teachers who want to focus on the weaknesses of evolution in the classroom. So that's where we are now. Thank you very much. Yes.
It all very much put to mind of a conversation I had with a young lady who I ran into a couple years ago, who's the head science educator at the Timber Lee Christian Camp. And when she found out that I was active in archaeology and all that, she was very enthusiastic and started telling me about this great new book she had been reading about where the dinosaurs came from in the fossil record. And evidently she was reading something about how somebody was proposing the idea that when Genesis says that there was a separation of waters, that was actually below and above. And I wasn't quite sure what she was trying to say, but basically what she said is that there was a water world above the atmosphere from which the dinosaurs and all the fossils had fallen at the time of the flood, and that's where the waters from the flood came from. I was quite fascinated to hear this. But it's...
Well, she's wrong.
Yeah, it seems... Really?
Even from a creationist perspective.
It's amazing the extent to which they really seem to be grasping at straws.
Well, here's what conventional creationists would say. Mm-hmm. At the time of the creation, God separated the waters above from the waters below. And that created a vapor canopy, is the term that they typically use, around mm-hmm. the earth. So that before Noah's flood, you had a greenhouse effect here. That's why you can find woolly mammoths up in Russia and places like that. And then when the flood came, you had the breaking up, according to the Bible, of the fountains of the deep, and those are the bottom stuff. And then the vapor canopy broke and poured no dinosaurs or anything up there, just lots of water. That came down and quickly flooded the earth. Now that also provides an explanation for something else. About middle of the century, creationists had to start wrestling with radiocarbon dating. Well, they say, of course, it's based on an assumption of uniform rates of production of C14. But if there were a vapor canopy until the flood, then that would have filtered out a lot of the cosmic radiation that produces C14 on the Earth. So we have a major discontinuity there. So the vapor canopy has done a lot of heavy lifting for the more scientifically minded creationist, but this dinosaur thing is just...
No, it surprised me. But also, as somebody who's engaged in public education, the thing that I thought was somewhat alarming is that I came into contact here because some local districts were sending their kids there for like little adventure outings and stuff like that, some of the public schools. And it seems to me that a backdoor way for an educator in a public school to throw creationism at their students is to book a visit to one of these places where they can do archery and they can mm-hmm. have fun stuff, mm-hmm. Rock climbing and that. And then maybe have a walkthrough through their seven-room halls of creation, each one highlighting a different day.
Or if you have money, you could go to Northern Kentucky and go to the museum.
Well, but here, right here in Wisconsin.
Oh, right here. Huh?
And you know, they draw public school kids.
Where?
This is over near Palmyra, Timber Lee.
Timber Lee?
It's a Christian camp.
And but they have a small museum?
Yeah, you could not call it a museum. They call it a science center.
Okay.
Long story short, I was working with another organization, and they wanted to do some crossover educating and stuff like that, which once I saw everything, I kind of said, thank you very much. We'll get in touch with you. But on that day, there were kids from public schools all over that south part of the state.
Not surprised.
Yeah, fourth grade.
I don't think evolution is taught very well at any level here, including the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah. You say it isn't taught very well?
No, it's not taught very well. I'll say it out loud. At the University of Wisconsin, and I hope they hear me. I think at a university such as ours, we need some really good general education courses that bring together the evidence for evolution. We want everybody to believe it, but we don't want to teach this stuff. And so they're really good advanced courses for specialists. There are only two that I know of that would come close to being an introductory course, one in anthropology and one in geology. But in some universities they have big, popular general ed courses where they're teaching it. And nobody's really taking up the challenge here.
I was wondering, to me, having to do that is like, let's have a general thing about gravity. Let's everybody find out what about gravity, and let's have the general courses for gravity and prove gravity, because it's so obvious. But you think that there's really that much doubt or that much misunderstanding or that much danger that people would actually be turned against evolution?
If strengths and weaknesses were offered, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it just seems so obvious that you don't really need to, you know, have courses on it until you're going to go specialize in it or whatever. But you're saying that there is a danger that people could be turned, you know, are being turned from it or don't believe.
Well, one of the most troubling signs, if I'm understanding you correctly, are the surveys of high school biology teachers. In many states, a significant percentage don't believe in evolution. And another significant percentage won't teach evolution because they're scared to death. So what you would do is be giving them a blank check to say whatever they want about evolution. We're just teaching about the weaknesses of evolution. I mean, there's no requirement that I know of that this be balanced. Plus, what evolutionary biologists would want to teach, give a balanced presentation of creation and evolution. So, Oh, there's one hand, and then back to you.
Yeah, I'd like to raise the issue of what we really mean by evolution. In Darwin's book, Chris Bush's book, was Origin of Species.
Yeah.
And yet, if you read the details of what he wrote in several places, especially when he talks about artificial selection creating different kinds of goats and dogs and so on, he says, well, I don't really know what species is. I don't know how to distinguish it from varieties. And yet, the basic notion that people have is that the creationists, I think that God created, quote, all of the species. And the fact is, most people don't understand how, in what sense, they use the name of the word species. My major professor, Herbert Mason, at Berkeley in the 1940s, taught me what I know about that. And it's very rare for me to meet even a well-trained professional biologist who understands this matter. And what a lot of creationists, a lot of evolutionists do to give examples, for example, of evolution, is point to disease organisms, bacteria, protozoans, and viruses, which have changed through time, mutated, and various other relatively trivial changes in populations, and define evolution as genetic changes in populations, and simply avoid the issue of species.
I think most of the time when biologists are referring to species these days, they're referring to populations that aren't cross-fertile. That's for example, if there are 12 species of mosquitoes here, what make them species is that they can't interbreed.
That won't apply to anything that's asexual.
Well, I know. But that's there are always problems. And the meaning of evolution that you raise is determining that is almost intractable. It's never had a stable meaning. One of the most prominent Darwinists in the late 19th century, hated evolution and loved Darwinism. It's even very difficult to distinguish in the 19th century between evolutionist and anti-evolutionist. I joke, but it's true. How many special interventions does it take to make one a creationist? The leading Darwinists in the 19th century in America required more special divine interventions than the last leading anti-evolutionist in America, who insisted on only three for matter, life, and humans. So that wouldn't even count as an anti-evolutionist, probably, in most places. But his self-identity and his public identity was as an anti-evolutionist. And then you have the problem, what is Darwinism? Well, Darwin wrote that his great goal in writing The Origin was to overthrow the dogma of separate creations, and that natural selection was kind of a favorite of his, but it was almost inconsequential compared to establishing what we would call common descent, or overthrowing the notion of special creation. And yet, some people would say, Darwinism is evolution by natural selection. Well, that's very unhistorical to say that. Darwin didn't believe that, and 19th century people did. Natural selection wasn't agreed on as the primary method of evolution until probably the 1930s or 40s. And Darwin never insisted exclusively on natural selection. So it's almost futile, except for navel-gazing historians of science, to try to figure out what these terms meant at any given time, because they're used in such very, very different ways, and in many cases continue to be used the way. Okay.
Can I just follow up just a second?
Sure.
Because it's really important. What people think are species, the kind of fuzzy notions they have without knowing very much about biology, turn out to be defined by well-educated taxonomists who have done thorough studies. They are the ones who decide what species are.
Of course.
In practice.
And then if it gets really contentious, then the courts will do it. In America.
That's actually the fact. That's the way it works.
Yeah. Yes, and then I'll go to the two.
I think an important thing, is this a real serious attack upon, was best represented by the Republican in 2008 when they had the bunch of Republican candidates and the question was asked, how many of you disbelieve in evolution, four hands went up. None of those, I think, was George W., but I'm not sure. But there were four hands.
Well, he wasn't running. So he wasn't in that group.
Okay. But four of those who were in the
you're right.
Disbelieved in evolution.
And then they picked a really strong young Earth creationist to run as vice president. I mean, she really had articulated her views a few times very specifically. Okay, two there and then you.
One thing I was wondering about that I really understood about creationism is that or intelligent design even, you're taking the hypothesis and it seems like you are adjusting the evidence to fit the hypothesis, which is sort of the antithesis of what science is about. So how is this reconciled in scientific circles where you're taking a hypothesis saying, you know, there's some kind of creator because of the complexity of life, and so therefore we're going to go through and we're going to find problems with this, with evolution based on the hypothesis that something created things, as opposed to saying, here's our hypothesis, let's test it and retest it and look at it in different ways and disprove it. That, to me, that's where the pseudoscience comes in. They completely ignore the scientific method. Is there any criticism based on that, or other questions?
Well, as a historian, I don't believe in the scientific method for this reason. It was a slogan deployed in the late 19th century to try to establish the authority of science as something very special. Anybody who looks at what scientists have actually done would find it impossible to generalize from what two scientists do, typically, unless they come out of the same lab, maybe. I mean, scientists are just like any other scholars. They try their damnedest to solve problems, and there's no predictable method, and scientists have done really weird things at times to solve problems. So the only place where there are only two places where the scientific method exists. One is in like introductory science textbooks, where they have a little discussion in the beginning, and the other is in the social sciences, where they're really trying to become scientists. So they teach courses in scientific methodology. I mean, can you imagine a graduate chemistry course in, you know, scientific methodology? I mean, they're not insecure about their scientific standing, is what I'm saying. So it's all, you know, where it's insecure that people have trouble. But it has done a lot of work in trying to convince the public that scientists really have some special thing. I don't know where would you get the scientific method from? Would you go to a field taxonomist or a theoretical physicist from which to generalize about what scientists typically do? So I'm not in that sense a big believer in something called the scientific method. I just see it as a useful slogan. Yes.
All right. Attacks on evolution in other countries, as in this one, but founded primarily in religion.
I think so. Most of the cases are supported by religion. Now, the one that I'm thinking about is maybe the trickiest answer here, is the Russian Federation after the fall of the Soviet Union, where creationism has been just being sucked in up there. And I do know that some of the key players are religious Christians, conservative Christians, especially their Pentecostals. But here's kind of the rationale. The Russian Ministry of Education, once the Soviet Union fell, invited American anti-evolutionists to come over and help write textbooks and curriculum materials and stuff like that. And here's their rationale. Look, for decades, we were stuck with the dogma of Lysenkoism, a non-Darwinian form of evolution that became, you know, even Stalin insisted on Lysenkoism. This was the orthodoxy there. And they say, that was so terrible. We don't want to go back to some other dogma like Darwinism. Let's have freedom and have all sorts of views of origins flourishing in this new country of ours. So it's not religious in one sense, although the people who really want it, I think, are very religious. But that's the closest I could come. The people who are participating in this just boggle my mind sometimes. I was in China a few years back, and turned out Chinese have translated some of the leading intelligent design books. So I couldn't read them, but I wanted to buy them anyway. Have everything. And I asked a Chinese colleague, I said, so who's publishing this? It was the Communist Party Press in Beijing. I said, why in the world would the Communist Party Press want to translate and publish intelligent design stuff? Aren't you guys supposed to be atheists over here? Well, he didn't know, but he said the best explanation he could come up with is that they do translate and publish books from the West that are attracting attention, because the Chinese need to be familiar with these currents. And there was a lot of people who were talking about Philip Johnson and Michael Behe, and so the Chinese needed to have access.
Maybe it was the pandas thing.
I did not find the panda book there.
They're studying us.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
But in almost every case that I have found, I know there are a few personal testimonies to the contrary, but in almost every case, a person grows up conservative religiously or converts to that, then becomes a creationist. There may be a few people who have, because of other reasons, become creationists, but that's the common track to get there. Yeah. Oh, yes, right back there. Yeah.
I was interested in the comment about defining species.
Mm.
And I always sort of thought the definition was that when there was enough genetic division, that when they got to the point where the animals can't reproduce together, that was sort of the dividing line. And I don't know that what science now says is any different than that. But what startled me is, not too long ago, I saw a case where a lion and a tiger, can you believe it, had bred with each other. And yes. This really sort of took me aback, because I assumed the difference between them was so great that they couldn't interbreed, but apparently they can.
But it's a sterile offspring.
Yes.
Same thing as what happens with horses, donkeys, mules, that little thing there.
But they're sterile, you say?
Yeah.
No, they're not all necessarily sterile. Not all hybrids species are sterile.
It's a matter of distance. The difficulty in defining species, when we look at human evolutions, for instance, it's one thing to talk about long separated species that we're looking at right now at this time. And we can say, okay, these clearly aren't going to breed. The parents are incompatible, like if you look at certain insects. The difficulty is defining when does one species grade into what we would call another species over time. That's a human construct. You know, we like to box things. But it's like if you spill two pails of paint on the floor, where does one color end and the other one begin once they blend together? And so it is a little bit of an artificial construct that you know, you can argue over that all the time. I had an anthropology professor who loved to talk about two archetype professors, Herr Splitter from Germany and Dr. Lumper from Malaysia. The idea of that scholars tend to fall into either splitters or lumpers. One guy will say every little tiny difference represents, you know, like in a fossil sense, represents a new taxonomy. And another guy will say, no, they're a big group, you know, they're all very similar, just a lot of genetic variation in there. So it's, do species exist from one another? Well, yes, but where is the color red different from the color white? Yes. But if you look over a population distributed over the planet, there's going to be some pink ones in the middle. And that's not that uncommon. So we like to box things. It's a human construct to an extent, but it is representing a biological reality. That, you know, there are the DNA that makes us up can be categorically different. We just had a speaker our last meeting who was talking about how at the end of the year we'll have the complete Neanderthal genome reconstructed from fossil DNA. It'll be fascinating to compare that then to the modern human genome. But again, when we talk about the human genome in humans, even within this room, there's a tremendous amount of variation. And this is what people don't really grasp, the concept of variation within a population genetically. And that's the complicated part.
There's four Priuses out front, or Priuses, I mean. There are two gray, one white, one blue. Why are there no red? Same thing.
Yeah.
I drew a green one.
Yes.
Do I understand you correctly that evolutionism is gaining among the Muslims? Did you say that?
Anti-evolutionism is.
Yeah,
there are two primary organizations, if you wanted to check up. Anti-evolutionists are making effective use of websites now, as are many other marketers. And the big one in the Muslim world is HarunYahya.com. It was founded by an imam whose original name was Adnan Oktar in Turkey. And he has produced... he and his group have produced over 200 books. The evolution deceit, probably, I've heard estimates ranging from a few million to over 8 million copies. Some of them are distributed free. It's hard to go into a Muslim place now where people don't know about HarunYahya. When I first started getting interested in this guy, I was talking to one of the leading Muslim scholars, and he said, Fringy, don't waste your time on this. Now when I see him, he says, every place I go, people ask me about HarunYahya and what's going on. And he's in the news a fair amount because his books are translated into dozens of languages and often distributed free. And one that was in the news a year or two ago was called The Atlas of Creation, which is a very big, beautifully illustrated book. It cost a fortune and many people, including me, got one free. They just were sending them out. So that's probably the biggest group. That is the biggest, most active group in the Muslim world. The most interesting one in the Islamic world, in the Jewish world, is the Torah Science Foundation. For a long time, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews didn't accept evolution, but they didn't worry about science. I mean, it was just a different world in some ways. But I think it was in 2000, a group of Israeli and American Jews, led by a biologist at UCLA, founded this organization. I think they get 1,000 or more to their conventions, and they go out of their way to stress their distance from Protestant fundamentalists, but it doesn't seem much different to me. So I describe it as just, you know, traditional creationism with a little Kabbalah mixed in to make it distinctive. But it's short, younger stuff. And they're very fervent, too. So,
is the Muslim also connected with the part of the West and the hate the West, or is it separate from that?
I wouldn't describe it as part of the hate the West. They go out of their way to distinguish themselves from Islamic fundamentalists. In fact, they argue, the Arun Yahya group argues that, unlike most Muslims, who are like most ultra-Orthodox Jews, Muslims don't engage science that much. You know, these issues, they don't, it's not imperative to reconcile the Quran with science in any way. So they see themselves as very modern for engaging science. Now, they happen to come out on the wrong side, but they are talking about science and doing a lot there. They tend to be very modern in dress and transportation and financially successful. Harun Yahya started out for 3 years. He was an interior designer. And he has a beautiful villa on the Asian side of the Bosphorus that he designed and his followers paid for. He's been in jail twice. He's under arrest again now. His opponents keep accusing him of various things, and he says, well, yeah, that's what they do to religious people, you know, drugs, sex, financial issues. I have no idea. I think if anybody wants to figure out what's going on in Turkey, good luck.
You'll hear a very loud ticking.
Yeah.
We had a
colleague here at the University of Wisconsin in neurology, who was an MD, PhD, who was one of the leading anti-creationists in Turkey, and would engage in various efforts to put down Harun Yahya's group and stuff like this. And he went back a few years ago to Turkey, and he's now in jail for advocating the overthrow of the government in a coup with some military group and stuff. And I can't figure out what's going on over there. I mean, they all demonize the other one. You know, so I don't know who the really bad guys are and who the really good guys are over there. Well, I know some of the good guys, but
this is fascinating, and I hate to leave, but I'm a diabetic getting low sugar, and my wife's got a drive, so we're not walking out.
Well, you're doing the right thing. Yeah.
Isn't there kind of a secondary level to the motivations of some of these groups, that it's not, that they're using the creation-evolution debate to delineate themselves on a moral level from where they associate evolution and modern science with a kind of debased and debauched way of life and philosophy, and they're trying to present themselves in opposition to that. And so, taking a moral opposing standpoint, they're also taking an intellectual opposing standpoint, almost secondarily?
Well, yeah, a lot of them connect evolution with materialism, mm-hmm. not philosophical materialism, but the attitude toward things, and toward the worst things in the West. There are even some scholars, there's a book supported by the Discovery Institute that was published by a mainstream press called From Darwin to Hitler, yeah. trying to link Darwinism with Hitler. It's a real reach. There's a little tiny bit of evidence. But this was one thing that motivated Brian and others, because not Hitler, but the Kaiser. That there was especially one book that came out, written by a prominent American biologist who spent nights with some captured members of the German High Command. I think they were captured, or else he was just hanging out with them. And learned that they had been motivated by survival of the fittest, might makes right type of philosophy, a little Nietzsche thrown in there. Mm-hmm. And that really bothered not only the creationist in America, but the evolutionist in America. And so you had a real effort among some evolutionists in the 20s to try to find evidence of the role of cooperation. A whole school of ethologists at the University of Chicago were motivated by trying to show that evolution depended more on cooperation than on competition, to try to get away from this old bad idea of evolution. But yeah, moral issues have been, moral and biblical issues have been the two really big ones that I've...
Yeah, works like Adam Smith's are all about competition and, you know, weeding out the weak. And we don't make those associations publicly at all. They don't, nobody's associating Adam Smith with being associated with evolutionary theory.
That's good. That'd be a little anachronistic.
Well, it would, but
yeah,
that too.
I mean, we wouldn't.
But it's
that.
The same kind of reach.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.